It's time we got back to the question of where Manjushri comes from. I've already mentioned that he's not found in the Pali scriptures. The Pali scriptures are, of course, the scriptures of the Theravada, or school of elders, form of Buddhism, which is one of the early Buddhist schools, in fact, one of the earliest. The Pali scriptures were not written down until several hundred years after the Buddha's parinirvana. But nonetheless, the oldest parts of the Pali scriptures undoubtedly reflect the actual conditions under which the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, lived and taught. They reflect, at least to some extent, the actual form that his teaching assumed. The Buddha, of course, lived and taught in 6th century BCE India, especially in northeastern India. So we find that the Pali scriptures give us, in fact, a great deal of information about life and conditions in India at that time. Information about the political situation, information about social life, economic life, information about manners and customs, about religious beliefs and superstitions, even information about things like sports and games. The Pali scriptures, in fact, are our main source of information about northern India during this whole period. And the result is that in the Pali scriptures we find the Dharma, we find Buddhism, deeply embedded in its historical context. We find it even overlaid to some extent by that context. In the Pali scriptures we find a Buddhism which is an historical phenomenon, a Buddhism which is determined by time, space and causality. A Buddhism which exists in terms of historical reality. A Buddhism which expresses itself in terms of historical reality, so to speak, but which the historical reality also obscures and conceals. Clearly, there's a parallel between the Buddhism of the Pali scriptures and the figure of Vimalakirti. A parallel in respect of their form, that is. Both belong to the realm of historical reality. They do not belong to the realm of myth. They do not belong to the realm of archetypal reality. Not that elements of myth, some elements of myth, are not found in the Pali scriptures. But they're found in a rudimentary, though still very beautiful form, mainly in the form of parables and extended similes. Similarly, in Mahayana sutras, like the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, there are elements of historical reality, but these occupy a distinctly subordinate place, distinctly subordinate position. In the Vimalakirti Nirdesha itself, for instance, we find ourselves in Amrapali's garden and in the city of Vaishali. But into this realm of homely historical reality, there erupts the realm of archetypal reality, of spiritual reality. Or rather, the realm of homely historical reality is made to open up in all directions into the realm of archetypal reality, as when Vimalakirti or the Buddha performs a miracle, so to speak, puts on a display of magical power. We also meet in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha personalities who are not familiar to us, not familiar to us from the Pali scriptures at all. We meet the Bodhisattvas. In particular, of course, we meet Manjushri himself. The Buddha is rather a special case. The Buddha of the Mahayana Sutra, the Buddha of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, that is. He's a very familiar figure, of course. After all, we've met him repeatedly in the Pali scriptures. But at the same time, as we encounter him in the Mahayana Sutras and in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, at the same time, he's an unfamiliar figure. In a way, he seems less like the Buddha. But in a way, he seems more like the Buddha than ever. However, I'm going on ahead a little too quickly. I've said that in the Pali scriptures, we find the Buddhism which expresses itself in terms of historical reality, so to speak, but which the historical reality also obscures and conceals. Some early Buddhists were not satisfied with this sort of situation. They wanted to take Buddhism, as it were, out of its historical context. They wanted to emancipate it, so to speak, from the limitations of a merely historical, even a merely earthly existence. The notion of history in the modern sense was probably quite unknown to them. But they were interested in the Dharma. They were interested in what the Buddha had said. They were committed, spiritually committed, to what the Buddha had said. They were not interested in the conditions under which he had said it. That is to say, the historical conditions. They were interested in the Dharma as a living spiritual truth, a living spiritual reality. They were not interested, as we only too often nowadays are interested in the West at least, in Buddhism as an historical phenomenon. For them, the Dharma really was Sanatana, eternal. Consequently, they started forgetting the actual conditions under which the Buddha lived and taught. They didn't seem to think those very important. They started forgetting the historical details. And they concentrated more and more on the Buddha as a purely spiritual personality. Concentrated more and more on the Dharma as a purely spiritual truth, a purely spiritual reality. They concentrated on bringing out the deeper implications of the Dharma. Not only that, not only did they emancipate the Dharma from the limitations of a merely historical existence, they also universalized it. They formulated it or reformulated it in such a way as to make it applicable, not just to the people of India, northern India, northeastern India in the 6th century BCE, but to all living beings whatsoever throughout time and throughout space. The Dharma had, of course, been that before in principle. The Buddha, after all, taught Bahujana Hitaya, Bahujana Sukhaya, for the happiness and benefit of all men, all living beings. But the fact had not been fully brought out. Those early Buddhists, also did something else. They adorned the Dharma. I always remember in this connection something that a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, said many, many years ago in Bombay. He said, and it's stuck in my mind ever since, that which we love, we adorn. In other words, that which we love, we decorate, we embellish, we beautify. So those early Buddhists who took the Dharma out of its historical context, who universalized it, must have loved it very much, because they certainly adorned it, they certainly decorated it magnificently. They set it in an ideal context, they set it in an archetypal context, they set it in an ideal realm, an archetypal realm. They set it in a realm flashing with light and glowing with colour, in fact, with all the colours of the rainbow. They set it in a realm where everything was made of jewels, where there was nothing but music and perfume in the air. In a word, they transferred the Dharma from the realm of historical reality to the realm of spiritual reality, from the realm of history to the realm of what I've called myth. And we can see this sort of process most clearly perhaps in the case of the Buddha himself. Before saying anything about this, however, perhaps I should make just one thing clear. It was this dehistoricizing, universalizing, idealizing tendency on the part of some early Buddhists that was one aspect of the development of Mahayana, of the Mahayana form of Buddhism, as it afterwards came to be known, of the tendency which eventually found expression in the Mahayana scriptures. In the Pali scriptures, the Buddha appears as a wandering religious mendicant. He's shaven-headed, probably just with a two-finger stubble, clad in ochre-coloured rags. We mustn't say robes, huh? Rags, huh? With a begging bowl, either of wood or metal, in his hand. And from a distance, he's indistinguishable from thousands of other wandering ascetics, such as you can see even today in India. The Pali scriptures themselves describe occasions on which the Buddha was not recognized by other people, even by bhikkhus at close quarters. But it's impossible not to recognize the Buddha of the Mahayana. It's impossible not to recognize the Buddha as he appears in the Mahayana scriptures, because he's seated on a lofty, elaborate, bejeweled throne. There's a canopy of jewels suspended, glittering above his head, and the begging bowl in his lap is seemingly carved from a solid block of lapis lazuli or emerald, and a brilliant golden light radiates from all parts of his body, particularly his head. And he teaches the Dharma. He teaches it not just for a few hours or for a few years or for the short span of a single earthly human life. He sometimes teaches it for ages upon ages, without stopping, without pause. And he teaches it in a purely spiritual realm, an archetypal realm. He teaches it to hundreds of thousands, even millions of living beings. And some of these beings are figures familiar to us from the Pali scriptures, Arahats, Ananda, Indra, but some of them are not familiar to us at all, that is to say, for example, the Bodhisattvas. And among the Bodhisattvas, of course, is Manjushri. So we can see now where Manjushri comes from. He comes from the very realm which he represents. He comes from the realm of myth. He comes from the realm of spiritual reality, archetypal reality.